Welcome to this episode of Against the Mountains of Madness. I'm your host, Jason.
And I'm John C. Wright.
And on this episode, we're going to be talking about fornication in space. More specifically, we're going to be looking at sex in science fiction books, different approaches to it, and different ideas that science fiction authors have tried to sell us about how we should do sex as a society or as an individual. So, John, sex in science fiction, where do we see it? What's a good book to start with?
A good book to start with. I, in my imagination, have compared and contrasted two books. One is Glory Road by Robert Heinlein, the Dean of Science Fiction. And the other is a book from a slightly earlier generation, which is A Princess of Mars by Edgar Rice Burroughs, which to some people is the seminal science fiction space opera. And the reason why science fiction writers are interested in this topic is because, of course, everyone's interested in the topic. Everyone wants to talk about romance and sex. But the different take that this genre has to have is they have to say what will be different in the future. Because you only want to write about things that are different and interesting. You don't want to write about things that are the same, because if you do, you're not really doing science fiction. So it's kind of a challenge to the imagination to say, what causes certain customs or certain taboos to be enforced, to be in place, and what might change if those were changed? Now, a lot of the science fiction I read when I was young was written in the 50s and 60s, and that was when the pill became widespread and widely used. And that actually was a technological change, a pharmacology that changed the behavior of the United States. The moral hazard of having sex out of wedlock suddenly became much lower because your chance of getting pregnant was lower than it had been.
Sort of.
It's not actually as it was sold to be. It's a lie. They said it was a lot more reliable than it should be. Well, and they also said it was moral, which is not.
Well, no, I was going to note that one of the side effects of the pill is it eroded the custom of chastity. But it eroded the custom of chastity even among people who are less responsible. So taking the pill, whatever you think of the morality of the pill as a technology, it is my understanding it's a relatively finicky technology in that you really need to take it the same time every day. You really need to be careful about if you're on antibiotics or something, it'll stop working. It's not sort of all that reliable. I mean, if you use it perfectly, it's like a condom. If you use it perfectly, it works pretty well for its intended purpose, but you have to use it perfectly. Anyway, sorry, that's just a side note. So as a result, for this wonderful birth control technology, we have a lot of bastards today. Not to put too fine a point on it.
Contraception is a grave moral error.
I agree.
In addition to that, in addition to the fact that it's wrong, that it's morally wrong to use contraception, it also doesn't work as advertised.
That's what I'm saying. I mean,
because what you're saying is people have a false idea about how reliable it is.
Oh yeah.
Now, they would not have that false idea if they were not allured to the lure of sex out of wedlock. If they didn't think that was just the most fun thing imaginable, they'd actually look into how dangerous this stuff was, because even when it works perfectly, it only works 9 times out of 10.
Oh, it's
and the 10th time, you're a dad. Dad, you're a mom. That's the 1 time out of 10 when it doesn't work.
It causes blood clots in women, too, and kills a couple of hundred of them, I think it is, every year. Like, it's a lethally dangerous technology. I mean, like, for the number of women that are on it, the risk of dying from blood clots is pretty small. But, I mean, the price of dying from blood clots is pretty high. So, you know.
Yeah. Like, so there's more than getting, 6 chambers. There's more than 6 chambers in the gun, but you're still playing Russian roulette.
Yeah, basically.
Okay. Now, here's the other thing. A science fiction writer who, if he lived before the days of the pill and was trying to anticipate what the social changes would be based on the technology, is writing a perfectly cromulent science fiction book. That's something that science fiction writers and readers are interested in.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the question is, Is he going to examine the good and the bad side effects of such a thing? Because you and I just mentioned 2 bad side effects, And we didn't even mention a third one, which was it changes female brain chemistry. It makes females attracted to undesirable mates as opposed to desirable mates.
Oh, yes.
The wrong time, at the wrong time of month, and so on and so forth.
There are a lot of stories of, I was on the pill, I went off the pill, and now I don't find my husband sexy anymore. I mean, it's a real problem.
The rate of homosexuality in male children also might be affected by the chemicals involved. And it might also get into the groundwater. And it might also cause frogs to be gay. I mean, there's a real science fiction writer, if he was writing about any technology, would look at both the good and the bad side effects.
Hmm.
You know, he would look at the car and he would look at the air pollution, for example. He wouldn't just paint a utopian picture.
Hmm.
Now, on the other hand, an honest science fiction writer would actually look at the sexual customs and see where they came from and what they were for and what would happen if you dismantle them. And not a single, I solemnly assure you, not a single science fiction book I read when I was a kid even remotely addressed that issue. Now, there was one science fiction book I read when I was a kid called Warlock in Spite of Himself. That had a scene where a Roman Catholic priest landed on a planet where there was a psychic moss that created magical effects. So the people there believed in magic because magic did seem to work. Anything they thought would actually magically happen, the moss would alter the psychic fields around them and it would come to pass. So there were magicians on the planet.
Mm-hmm.
So he runs into a nymph. He runs into a supernatural being who is alluring to men and who wishes to copulate with him. And he stops and tells her why it's wrong. He tells her that every time she sleeps with someone, she gives away part of her immortal soul to cleave to that person. And if he then goes away and doesn't reciprocate the love that she just offered, it diminishes her and it wounds her. Now, as a kid reading this at 13, 14, it's the only time I ever heard anyone mention any drawback to the sex act. It's the only time I ever heard anyone say that there was a meaning to it, or that it was for a purpose, or that it... and that if you did it wrong, it could hurt you, you know. And this was not even a guy talking about sex, fathering bastards, okay? This is a guy just talking about the spiritual and mental, psychological problems you get into.
But most of those authors would have been materialists and atheists of one stripe or another, so they wouldn't believe there was a spiritual component to the act.
And they also don't believe in psychology, I assume, because of course that's what the scene was. The priest was talking about the psychology of it.
Okay, I mean,
but yeah, you're quite correct.
I should clarify for everybody listening. You may hear me say things like, "Oh, you know, this wonderful technology." I think these things are bad. I'm a Roman Catholic. I accept the church's teaching on all of this. If you hear me saying things like that, I'm either simply playing the devil's advocate and saying, you know, looking at it from the perspective of it's billed as this wonderful technology, but it doesn't really work as well. And, you know, even if it worked as advertised, it doesn't really work as advertised. So
correct.
Just in case anyone's like going, we need to burn him because he's clearly a heretic. I'm actually not.
No, I thought you were being sarcastic. That's why I wanted
often,
to emphasize the point.
Yeah, just playing devil's advocate to, you know, like, let's look at it on the terms they're selling it, and let's see if it even makes sense on those terms, because usually it doesn't. I mean, it doesn't even live up to the false billing they're giving it. So
let's say it functioned as designed. Let's say that you could have sex at a wedlock without any repercussions.
Without bothering anybody. Let's say you could, and it still doesn't really work. So,
here's what happens.
Go on.
You get Glory Road by Robert Heinlein.
Mm-hmm.
Let me describe that book in some detail, and also compare it and contrast it with A Princess of Mars. In fact, as a mental exercise, I would like to read the physical description of Dejah Thoris, the Princess of Mars from The Princess of Mars, and the physical description of Star, the sexy space empress. This is about a paragraph each.
I'm sorry, is that actually her name?
No, her name is Star.
Oh, right.
And she's an empress of outer space, but I call her the sexy space empress because that's her sole Her only role in the book is to be the woman who teaches him, who teaches the ignorant Earthman that our Earth customs of chastity are a foolish hoax that merely deprive people of the fun and the wonder of sexual congress. You see, Heinlein is trying to make the argument that we do not know how fun sex is. We married men who have fathered children do not know what sex is for or how much fun it is. That's his claim.
Heinlein has the attitude to sex of a 15-year-old boy.
I wish I'd believe that, because if I believed that, I wouldn't be angry at him. If I thought he was merely naive and stupid, I would not think he was lying to me as a child.
No,
but
no.
As it is, I'm angry with him because when I grew up, I realized he was lying to a child, which is terrible. Why are you lying to a child? A child does not have enough experience to know you're lying to him, you know?
No. What I meant was that fantasy of casual sex with many, many women is the dream of a 15-year-old, and it's not the dream of it's not the dream of anybody that's actually found a faithful spouse and has found a faithful spouse to have a family with and that sort of thing. That sort of endless conquest is the dream of a 15-year-old or someone who's been hurt really badly. has been betrayed and is hurt deeply. That's not a fantasy and a desire of a well-adjusted adult male.
No. In fact, it's the opposite.
Exactly.
It's mildly disgusting.
Oh,
but you're right. You also have to add a third. You also have to add a third group: someone too naive to know it's wrong, someone who's been hurt and psychologically scarred and doesn't know it's wrong, and someone who's just a cad. There are grown men who still are trying to collect boasting rights on as many trollops as they can poon.
I think
it's just disgusting. And there's guys who do that. Who act that way.
I think those guys are broken.
I don't know their hearts. You could be right.
I think they're broken. Anyway, we'll come back to it. Tell your story, please.
Greetings, world. This is John C. Wright. I and my compatriot, Jason Rennie, take up arms weekly against the mountains of madness that are afflicting and overwhelming the modern age. You are welcome here among like-minded souls, and I hope we have provided a work of insight, hope, or humor, and perhaps an explanation of the insanity that is the modern age. For more content and conversation on these and other fascinating topics of philosophy, science fiction, and current events, please visit our Substack at atmom.substack.com. Tips, bribes, and generous patronage are warmly encouraged. Thank you. I'm willing to concede the point. There's got to be something wrong with them because it's like seeing someone who leaps into a banquet and instead of deciding what food to eat, he goes picking one piece of food off of other people's plates through the restaurant. Now that's not a normal behavior.
Well,
okay, there's something psychologically wrong with that guy.
Yeah. Well, I mean, they're not science fiction shows, but there's two movies and a TV show. I always thought. Did an interesting representation of this. I don't think it was necessarily intended in two of the cases. Did you ever watch How I Met Your Mother?
No.
Oh, it's an interesting TV show about a guy telling the story of how he met his wife, but there's a married couple in it that have ups and downs, but are sort of happily married despite all the, it's not completely smooth sailing, but they're happy. But there's another character, Barney, who basically spends the entire series, his golden life is to sleep with 200 women. And he's got a list and he's keeping the names. And the Barney character always struck me as, he's like, happy-go-lucky, look how amazing my life is. I'm getting all these chicks and I'm doing amazing. But he's always seems this, like, underneath is this deeply sad character who doesn't actually like this and I mean later in the series he ends up wanting more and getting married and that doesn't work out, but I mean it was just I always thought the character was interesting because he was portrayed as on the surface he was look how amazing I am, slaying all this I'm not going to say that word. That's fine. I can't find
a... We'll just say being a skirt chaser, a lady killer.
Yes. Right. And, but he's always, he seems like a sad character that's never happy with that. There was the Adam Sandler film, The Wedding Singer, where there was a character similarly whose entire personality was at a ladies' man. But later in the series, later in the movie, he admits actually he's miserable. He's really like, you don't want to be like me. This is no way to live.
Yeah, yeah.
And there was the funniest take I ever saw on it was there was a film, The Wedding Crashers, with Owen Wilson and, oh, I forget. Anyway, not important. But their whole shtick is they go to weddings, they be the life of the party, and they pick up women to sleep with at the wedding. And they learn this from another character at college. But over the course of the movie, one of them falls in love, gets his heart broken, then goes back to chasing the women because he's been wounded by the whole thing. But then they catch up with their old friend who still lives with his mother, but he's gotten more sophisticated and now goes to funerals and is like weeping, oh, he's gone, and picking up vulnerable women at funerals. And it's just the saddest, most pathetic thing you've ever seen. But wow. It's just, you know, like... I found these different movies and TV show fascinating because they had the lady killer character, but they're miserable, and they portray them as just pathetic and miserable. But yeah, I don't know. Anyway, sorry, that's a diversion. But it's fascinating to me that they'll portray them as miserable characters. But only if you look a little more closely. It's not obvious they're miserable on the surface. So
what you're describing, I haven't seen any of those movies, but what you're describing is an honest as opposed to a dishonest portrayal of reality. What you're describing is the writer did his job.
Yeah. Well, I think...
He didn't lie to a child like Bob Heinlein did.
Well, yes. So what did Bob Heinlein do to you? Show me on the doll that Bob Heinlein touched you.
Let me interrupt and I'll tell you where he touched me in a second, but let me interrupt and say there's another movie, and this is not a science fiction movie, but a historical movie called 1776, which is the musical comedy version of the American Revolution, of the Constitutional Convention, where they decide on writing the Declaration of Independence.
Mm-hmm.
And what the songwriter there did is he decided that all the men in those days were lusty for their wives, and there's really cute and really kind of risque lyrics where they're describing to their wives how they want to walk in Cupid's Grove together with them. And one of the main plot points is that Jefferson, who was a bit of a lusty man, wanted to get home to his wife to have the warm commerce with her in order to get his creative juices flowing so he could write the Constitution. So he could write the Declaration of Independence. And it's hilarious. And it's a little risque. I mean, I wouldn't necessarily show it to an impressionable child, but it's a... For a grown-up, of course, it's treating the waltzing through Cupid's Grove with the ribald dignity of, let's say, a medieval poet. It's Chaucerian. It's like Chaucer in its respect for the for sexual congress. You can deal with these things in a way that is not necessarily puritanical, without going full bore. Crazy town. Does that make sense? What I'm saying? The idea that someone who thinks sex is sacred and should be restricted to man and wife in love, into romantic as opposed to exploitative, the idea that we don't like sex, that we have a bad sex life, and that we're not having as much fun as the losers who go from girl to girl to girl. That guy who wants to sleep with 200 women. What he said is, I want to make 199 women miserable and ruin their lives. I want to deflower 199 women so that their relations with their husbands afterwards will be diminished. You see? Because I'm sorry, if you come to the marriage bed not a virgin, your sex life is diminished. Mm-hmm. It's just a fact.
I would note, you said to get all puritanical. Apparently, the irony of that cultural trope, at least, is the Puritans in their letters to their wives, very racy. the Puritans were not about sleeping around, but once you are married, you know, enjoy your marital bed as fully as possible was definitely sure. where the Puritans were at.
So the idea that Puritans are puritanical even back in the day was was fake news.
Hmm.
Okay. So that's the straw man. The idea of the puritanical Puritan is the straw man that Robert Heinlein is jousting against.
Hmm.
He wants to throw down the Victorian morality, which he regards as unfun. Victorians are just out to spoil people's the joy we get from sleeping around. Okay.
Well, that
now,
may have,
anyone
that,
with
that,
a half a
that,
brain knows the joy you get from sleeping around is like the joy you get being a drunk or being addicted to opium or being addicted to gambling or anything else that's a vice that slowly robs you of all joy in life, you know.
I have seen more than one story talking about male porn actors who just end up just unable to enjoy sex with women.
Sure.
And apparently Hugh Hefner later in life, yes, that Hugh Hefner of Playboy Mansion and Playboy Bunny fame, spent his time, the only way he could enjoy himself was masturbating alone to gay pornography, apparently. So the story says.
I'm not surprised. One of the things that changed me from being a sexual libertarian to being a Puritan, by which I mean a guy who thinks sex is too important to waste it on bachelors.
Yep.
Okay. The one thing that changed my mind is there were several things, but this was a big one. I saw a documentary about Hugh Hefner in his later in life when he was a grandfather type age. Okay. And he was surrounded by the most attractive, most scantily clad women in California.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so he's in the Playboy Mansion with the Playboy Bunnies. That's the harem fantasy that you were just talking about, the 15-year-old boy's fantasy. And I looked in his empty eyes, his soulless, unhappy, empty eyes as he was speaking, trying to be lighthearted about the deep misery of his life. And I said, oh, my dear Lord. And this was back when I was an atheist. I didn't even believe in the dear Lord at that point. And I said, oh, my dear Lord, that guy is, he's going to blow his own brains out. That guy's life is a sack of pain. And he doesn't have what I have because I'm a happily married man. You know, I felt pity for this guy. Now, I'm not a man who is given to pity. It's one of the biggest problems I have being a Christian because I've been ordered by my boss to feel charity, to feel pity for people, but I felt it for him. I would not have accepted his life for any reward in earth and heaven.
That's it.
You know, he lost his soul. He's the guy that they talk about who got everything he wanted in life but lost his soul. So
yeah. Well, Michael Knowles had an interview with a former porn star, male porn actor, who now came to Jesus and is now starting a ministry. But there's a few stories like that. But he was saying, like, he got best actor of the year. He won that 2 or 3 years in a row. But he'd reached the peak of his career, and he was intent on blowing his brains out. I think he was going to overdose, but he'd planned to kill himself till a teller at the bank used his real name, because he'd just been going by his stage name for years apparently, and asked him if he was okay, and that was the start of turning things around for him and coming to Christ. But
yeah,
he was saying, like, the number, like, he knew 30 people that had committed suicide in the industry that he was working, and countless others who had died from, you know, like, got drunk and fell over a balcony and just died from crazily reckless living. And
yeah, because they're actually trying to kill themselves in such cases.
But
when you subconsciously realize you're not worthy of life, you will try to do yourself in.
Mm.
You know.
But it was just, I'm afraid. Oh, it was tragically sad, and, like, you know, a porn star sleeping with 1,000 women. Whoa, like, wow, what a life. That sounds amazing. It's not really,
it sounds
awful, but
you get to lick the outside of 1,000 apples, but never take a bite. Thank you. Because it's a mimicry, it's a mockery of love. It's a mockery the same way a vampire or a walking corpse is a mockery of a living being. Mm. It's not really a living being. It's not really a thing. It's a disgusting puppet of love. Because real love is the source and the summit of all life. It's what biology is for. It's the reason why the amoeba was bored and decided to invent bisexuality. And I don't mean it, and I mean real bisexuality. I mean two sexes. You know. So all the science fiction guys when I was young, and I mean all of them except for one, tried to press this agenda on impressionable youngsters, apparently with great success, because apparently the society was moving that way, and we're much closer to Robert Heinlein's utopia of endless orgies, endless worldwide orgy, than we are toward the Victorian decency of the Victorians. So, but sadly,
yep.
are the promise of freedom that the sexual libertarians held out was fake, because now they're the Puritans. They're the ones who clutch their pearls and sniff whenever you say things like, maybe we should only have sex inside marriage. They go, oh my gosh, you're a homophobe. Oh my gosh, you're a sexophobe.
They're enslaved.
Oh my gosh, you're a racist.
Yeah, they're enslaved to... So, anyway, Stahl, the 60s stage princess... Let me interrupt again.
My wife calls them the Impuritans, and this is the kind of thing that...
That's a good name for them.
This is Deja Thoris, the daughter of Mors Kajak of Heliam on Mars.
Sure.
And the sight which met my eyes was that of a slender, girlish figure, similar in every detail to the earthly women of my past life. She did not see me at first, but just as she was disappearing through the portal of the building, which was to be her prison, she turned, and her eyes met mine. Her face was oval and beautiful in the extreme, and her every feature was finely chiseled and exquisite. Her eyes were large and lustrous, and her head was surmounted by a mass of coal-black, waving hair, caught loosely into a strange yet becoming coiffure. Her skin was of a light reddish copper color, against which the crimson glow of her cheeks and the ruby of her beautifully molded lips shone with a strangely enhancing effect. She was as destitute of clothes as the green Martians who accompanied her, and indeed, save for her highly wrought ornaments, she was entirely naked, nor could any apparel have enhanced the beauty of her perfect and symmetrical figure. So I want it to be noted by all and sundry that this is Deja Thoris, the Princess of Mars, who, like everyone in space, is a nudist, okay? Because they don't need Earth clothes back in the day. Now, John Carter of Virginia falls in love with this woman, and she will not accept him at first because he does not know the customs of Mars, and she's been promised to the son of a prince of an enemy country in order to create peace with that country. So on the wedding day, he decides to go in and see her. This is after she changes her mind and confesses her love to him, but her sense of duty forces her to go through with the wedding. Now, I should mention, Edgar Rice Burroughs, in real life, fell in love with a girl who eventually ended up marrying another man, and it broke his heart, you see. So he really wanted to do this, and what this is John Carter goes in and breaks up the wedding and kidnaps the bride at the altar, okay? Now, before he does that, he goes to try to have a conversation with her to find out if she really loves him or not. Because he's trying to decide whether or not to break up the wedding. Because, of course, it's insanely dangerous, and he's going to be stabbed and shot with radium pistols. And if you're shot on Mars, man, it's bad, because the radium pistols carry atomic explosive bullets. Okay, this was written back before they knew what atomics were. So he is... in the enemy city, but they're not his enemies. They actually treated him well, and he owes them some gratitude, and the prince hires him as one of his guards. So he's there on guard duty when he hears that the princess of Mars has come, that Deja Thoris is in the building. So he goes to try to speak with her, and the four guardsmen say, wait, you can't come in here without a password. And he puts his hand on his sword and says, this is my password! And the chief of the four guards says, but we outnumber you. And before he's done with the sentence, John Carter has stabbed that guy through the heart. And so it's now only 3-1. So he fights them back and forth in the chamber for 20 minutes and raising a huge ruckus, okay, of the clatter of swords and so on and so forth. And after killing all four, he says this, they were brave and noble fighters, and it grieved me that I should have been forced to kill them. But I would have willingly depopulated all Barsoom could I have reached the side of my Dejathoris in no other way? Barsoom is the Martian word for Mars. So that, by the way, that is romance. That is what true lovers think true love is. If you're not willing to depopulate a planet to get to your girl, your love is weak water compared to the strong wine of romance. Okay. That's the way back in the Victorian day, because Edgar Rice Burroughs lived when the gas lamp was the way they would light cities, okay?
Mm-hmm.
He was science fiction by gaslight. That's the way love and romance was portrayed in those days. Let us compare and contrast. This is Star, the Sexy Space Empress.
Yep.
The main character, Oscar Gordon, is an ex-veteran who answers an ad for a hero. He's not sure if it's for real or if it's a trick, you see. And he's lounging about on the beach in southern France, which is a nudist beach, and he sees a vision of loveliness walk by. Girl, woman, I couldn't be sure. At first glance, I thought she was 18, maybe 20. Later, when I was able to look her square in the face, she still looked 18, but could have been 40 or 140. She had the ageless beauty of perfect beauty, like Helen of Troy or Cleopatra. It seemed possible that she was Helen of Troy, but I knew she wasn't Cleopatra because she was not a redhead. She was a natural blonde. She was a tawny toast color all over without a hint of the bikini marks, and her hair was the same shade, two tones lighter. It flowed unconfined in a graceful waves down her back and seemed never to have been cut. She was tall, not much shorter than I am, and not too much lighter in weight. Not fat at all, save for that graceful padding that smooths the feminine form, shading the muscles underneath. I was sure there were muscles underneath. She carried herself with the relaxed power of a lioness. Her shoulders were broad for a woman, as broad as her very feminine hips. Her waist might have seemed thick on a lesser woman. On her, it was deliciously slender. Her belly did not sag at all, but carried the lovely double-domed curve of perfect muscle tone. Her breasts, only her ribcage could have carried such large ones without appearing too much of a good thing, but they jutted firmly out and moved only a trifle when she moved, and they were crowned with rosy-bound confections that were frankly nipples, womanly and not virginal. Her navel was the jewel that the Persian poets praised. Her legs were long for her height. Her hands and feet were not small, but were slender and graceful. She was graceful in all ways. It was impossible to think of her in any pose ungraceful. Yet she was as lithe and limber that, like a cat, she could have twisted herself into any position. Her face? How do you describe perfect beauty except to say that when you see it, you can't mistake it. Her lips were full and her mouth rather wide. There was a faint curve in the ghost of a smile, even when her features were at rest. Her lips were red, but if she were wearing any makeup of any sort, she had applied it so skillfully that I could not detect it. And that alone would have made her stand out, for that was the year when all the other females were wearing continental makeup, as artificial as a corset and as bold as a doxy smile. Her nose was straight and large enough for her face, not a button nose, and her eyes, she caught me staring at her. So, now, as an artist, I noticed there's a slight distinction between these two descriptions. Both of them are describing a nude woman who is completely gorgeous.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, is it just my imagination that in the one of them, the first one is completely romantic, like looking at a statue of a classical Greek goddess, and the second one is pornographic, like looking at a centerfold?
Yes.
The second description is meant to engage your prurient interest and not to see her as an object of possible love, you know?
She's described as an object to slake your lust on.
Correct. Now, don't get me wrong, Dejathoris is just as beautiful. She's got her black hair and a strange alien coiffure, and she's wearing nothing but jewelry, but there's something elegant about the description that makes her look like she's worthy of respect and love. Whereas this girl's just a hottie. Okay.
Is this what we're presented with? A woman to slake your lust on, or you need to be willing to commit genocide for her?
Here's the thing.
Is there a middle ground here somewhere, maybe?
If you're not willing to kill at least four men for your wife, I mean, look, Helen launched 1,000 ships.
Four's fine,
many ships would you launch for your wife? Because I would go 1,001. Why? Because my wife is better than Helen of Troy to me. But keep in mind, this is it's a romance. You don't actually want to have to kill people to get to your wife, but you understand what the appeal is.
I understand.
It's supposed to be an adventure story.
I understand. I was just thinking in the back of my head. So Adolf Hitler was the greatest lover, was the greatest romantic of all time.
No,
I mean obviously not. No, I mean obviously not. But
one, he did not kill even 1/10 of the people as Mao.
That's true.
First, second, he didn't even kill half the people as Stalin, and third, he wasn't married. Okay,
that's fine. That's fine. No, that's, so, right. That's right. So I was, he's sorry.
Not. If he was sorry. Doing, if he was conquering Europe for a woman, you know. If Napoleon had been doing it for Josephine instead of for the revolution, I would have more respect for him.
Fair. No, I mean, I'm sorry. But I am a romantic. It was intended as a joke, not
I got
serious.
I got the joke, and I said the joke back at you.
Fair enough. That's all good. But, yes.
So here's... Star of the Sexy Space Empress is not just the Playboy Bunny. She's also supposed to be the Fountain of Wisdom, the Aisha Return of She, the goddess from the old days. That's why he describes her as being perhaps 150 years old. You see, she's supposed to be older than him and to lead him into the gardens of pleasure, to for him to find out that his Midwestern upbringing has betrayed him. So let me tell you that the central event that made me angry with him. I should say I'm not really angry. I've kind of gotten over it, but it's funny to say that you're angry with someone that wrote a book you read when you were 13. But it's a joke. But there's a core of truth to it. I think that writers should take care not to put lies in their stories, because 13-year-olds will read them, you know. Now, I read this when I was young, and my only experience with romance was I had a crush on Yvonne Craig when she dressed up as Batgirl in the 1968 live-action Batman, okay? That's fair all enough. I knew about women.
Fair enough. So, fair enough. 1960s Batwoman, not Batwoman, 1960s Catwoman.
Yes, I would. I hate to say it, but I think I would have turned to a life of crime, you know, just to be near her.
Yes.
But I also saw how she killed off her henchmen whenever she was unwilling to split up the gold. So you can never trust those femme fatales.
So. Anyway, sorry, I'll let you continue.
What's funny is Julie Newmar, who is the Catwoman, could have fit this description if she had been blonde of Star of the Sexy Space Empress, because she was like 6 feet tall, and she was absolutely gorgeous, and she was, you know, a giant glamorous Amazon, what we call a glamazon. So the glamorous space empress recruits Oscar to go on a adventure down the Glory Road, and the circumstances of the adventure require that they step from one dimensional portal to the next through a number of different worlds to get to the Dark Tower, where he has to fight Cyrano de Bergerac or something in a sword fight to get the MacGuffin, which is called the Phoenix Egg. Now, the book is appealing because there's a passage, which I will not read to you, at the beginning, where Oscar mentions everything he wants to do in life, and it's all these most romantic, adventurous things that he's picked up from old books, stories, and epics. And it's a brilliant passage, and my hat's off to Robert Heinlein, the man who had to write, you know, when he could write. And even when he's writing filth, he's writing it in a really entertaining and avuncular way, you know. So give him his credit where credit is due. But I just wish he would use his immense powers for goodness and not for evil. So here's the evil scene. Oscar and the sexy space empress go to stay overnight at the house of a big kind of barbarian Texas rancher who's very generous and very hail fellow well met, a Falstaff type, a hard drinker. He's got a wife and three daughters, and he's got immense retainers, and they all have a big party. And that night after the feast, Oscar is welcomed as a hero. And it's the custom of that world that whenever a hero comes by, he's supposed to copulate with the unmarried daughters of the host so that they can reproduce more heroes as a matter of politeness and eugenics. Now, Oscar the Earthman is unfamiliar with these customs, so when that night after he's been drinking, and he lays down in bed, and there's a knock at the door, and one naked girl after another appears at his door and wants to copulate with him. He says, "Oh no, I'm not in the mood. Thank you." Well, this violates the customs of the barbarians, and so they throw out the empress and the hero, who are now slinking down the road. And when Oscar Gordon reveals to Star the sexy space empress what he had done, that he hadn't slept with the women offered him, the trollops offered to him, She does what no woman in all creation, plus 90 creations to either side of us, have ever done or ever will do, through all of time from creation to apocalypse, plus alternate timelines, including the Mirror Mirror universe, where everything is backward. Okay, no women act this way. Okay?
Yep.
She goes, how dare you not sleep with other women aside from me? I wish you to copulate with other younger women than me and to, you know, spread your seed into them with great thrusting abandon, she says to him. Not in those words.
Mm.
So he goes, woe is me. How could I have been so foolish as to abide by the Earthman customs, because they're clearly wrong. So he goes back. He copulates with the three girls. They all is forgiven. They're entertained for the party. And the Empress says this to him. Your culture is the only semi-civilized one in which love is not recognized as the highest art and given the serious study it deserves. Please note how she's using the word love in that sentence.
Yes.
She means... and then he says, he thinks to himself, back home we didn't study love, much less attempt to teach it. Ballet takes years and years to practice. You know, heck, you had to learn even to be a fry cook, much less a gourmet. So sudden sorrow overcomes him for his quote-unquote poor unhappy compatriots cheated of their birthright by the most mammoth hoax in history.
Oh, dear.
Now, he doesn't dwell on the point, so you have to just try to imagine what he means by the most mammoth hoax in history. I'm thinking he's thinking chastity is a mammoth hoax. The idea that you should only raise the children your wife produces from your seed, that's the hoax. Because what Oscar Gordon... Now, unless I misunderstood the point of the barbaric custom, I believe it says in the text that it's forefathering heroes. Okay?
Yeah.
That means that this guy, Oscar Gordon, was deliberately trying to copulate with these women, not for the sake of sexual pleasure, which is selfish and exploitative, and demeans the women by literally treating her as an object, but also he was trying to father a bastard.
Yep.
He wanted another man to raise his child. And it occurs to me that if the child he fathers is a girl, she's going to be raised there and be given to any other wandering heroes in the future. How's that, Dad? Do you want your daughter to be raised that way? Does that seem to you like that's the responsible thing to do with your seed, with your male member? Is that the way you want it to be used to bring about that outcome? So when I reread this book as a grown-up and I saw that was in it, I went, oh my goodness, how could he possibly say to the poor... Look at the poor 13-year-old with a crush on Yvonne Craig as the Batgirl, okay? That poor sap believed your garbage, you know?
Yeah.
Now, I gotta say, in college, I tried to chase skirts around, and thank be to the Lord, I was really bad at it. As you can imagine, I was a science fiction bookish geek, and so, you know, any woman with any taste would be repelled. I don't mean to make you blush, but I came to my marriage bed as a virgin, you know, because I happened to find a woman who Cupid had blinded her. Who even knows why? It's inexplicable. But at least I didn't father bastards on some foreign barbarian planet and then think the barbarians were better than my culture? What's wrong with this guy?
Mm.
Because the opposite happens on Mars. When John Carter of Mars goes to Mars, he's the only decent guy who knows about things like chivalry and mercy toward fallen enemies. And because of that, he makes friends with Tars Tarkas, the most powerful warlord of the Green Martians. And he also befriends Wula the dog, who was the watchdog sent to watch him. And because of that, he's able to get away. Because he treats people with kindness and respect, which they've forgotten how to do on Mars, the Martians become more decent around him and more powerful because they can now gain allies that other Martian groups can't. And so he ends up conquering most of the planet, okay?
Nice.
He doesn't go to Mars and say, hey, the Martians are right about this. Let's stab our fallen enemies in combat like the Martians do. You know? He says, no, he's going to bring his Earth customs to Mars. And he wins. Hmm. Okay? That's not what happens to Bob Heinlein. Now, in all fairness to Bob Heinlein, our friend here, Oscar Gordon the hero, is not happy with his life after he's done walking the glory road. He gets to live with the sexy space empress as one of her many concubines or husbands or something. And she doesn't pay any attention to him after that because she has official government duties. And he goes to parties, and he has money, and he doesn't have anything he needs to do. And his wife doesn't care if he sleeps around. And so he's like one of those beautiful rats in that famous psychological experiment with nothing to do.
Mm.
And the end of the book is him deciding to go out on adventuring again, just to put his life in danger, just because he's bored. And that's the happy ending of the book.
That's a happy ending.
I'm not sure even Bob Heinlein accepted the premise of his own book. He might have been being tongue-in-cheek on more than one level, because writers are tricky people, and they sometimes say complicated things in their books.
Mm.
But he did go out of his way to call Chastity a mammoth hoax. You know.
Well, I got to be honest. I mean, it's like looking at a car. It's like looking at a train wreck. But I follow a number of Facebook groups that post various dating profiles from Tinder and the like of women, and they have this Chastity-free, unlimited buffet of men of whatever they want, and they seem more miserable than ever, and they seem miserable and delusional. So I'm not sure it's the paradise he painted it as.
No.
There was an Amazon series called Uploaded about uploading your mind and living forever in a computer world if you're wealthy enough. It was a good series. I enjoyed it. Well, I've enjoyed the first two seasons. I don't know if they're making more. But I had one scene in it where one of the characters who wasn't dead, who was still alive, is basically on a hookup app where she's met up with a guy, fornicated with him. Let's use the technical term, and then they rate each other like an Uber driver and an Uber passenger rate each other at the end of a journey, and the expectation is you give each other 5 stars and. That's horrific. That's so awful. And this was sort of portrayed as normal in this world. And I mean, I don't think it's that bad yet, but that's where all of this sort of hookup culture and dating apps is going. And
and
the dating apps are, oh my goodness. I mean, okay, I've met my second wife on Plenty of Fish. But man, that place is, I mean, like that was providence in the hand of God, because that place is a dumpster fire.
It's got a good name though. You have to admit that's a pretty clever name.
It's a good name for a dating app, but like, not to be too critical, but I turned 48 the other day. I was in my early 40s when my first wife passed away, and you know, I decided to get back out. Thank you. I decided to get back out there. I didn't want to live alone. But just the dating profiles were amazing. You know, like this is supposed to be this ideal that Heinlein was working towards. What do you think? Okay, so on it had length of longest relationship was one of the things that. The website, like when you were filling out your profile, was one of the things.
Sure.
And it maxed out at, because I'd been married for 14 years. So I just, you know, I put 14 years. So my profile said longest relationship more than 10 plus years. So I'd gone off the top end of the scale. But at the other end, the shortest one was, the lowest setting was less than 6 months. Now,
yeah, one night stand.
Now, if you're 22 and your profile says less than 6 months is your longest relationship, sure, you know, I can believe that. When you're 40, that's what it says, or it says less than a year or 1 to 2 years or something like that. What, like, oh my goodness. I mean, I'm guessing Heinlein would consider this some sort of paradise, but that's a nightmare. Like, that's horrendous. How do you, I guess I guess you could get to that age and you'd find someone who's never been in a relationship, maybe. I mean, you find sort of outliers like that occasionally, but...
Well, here's the funny thing about Heinlein. From reading his biography, as best I could tell, he was married to a woman named Virginia for his whole life. I don't remember if he had a previous wife, if he was a divorcee or not. But he was in a stable married relationship for quite a period of time. Now, he was also a swinger. His wife went out to like bars and you know places like that with him. But of course, swingers in the 50s were not were Puritans compared to our modern generation. So,
well, it would seem so. Well, now being in a poly relationship is all of the rage.
He also advocated that in other books. You can read about those in Moon is a Harsh Mistress.
And yes.
You can read about those in a book that's not called Stranger in a Strange Bed, but it should be. And the promise of that is the Martian doesn't understand any Earth customs, and when he finds out about sex, he wants to have sex with all the women he can. So he starts a bogus religion to seduce women to have sex with him.
Well, so, I mean,
I wonder if I if sometimes you want, wonder if you want to do L. Ron that. Hubbard. I sometimes wonder if L. Ron Hubbard might have gotten some inspiration from his fellow science fiction writer.
Well, possibly. Well, you know, I mean, if you want to have sex with lots of women, starting a cult and being the leader and making one of the precepts of the religion that you get to sleep with all of the wives. Does yep. seem to be the way to go. It usually ends.
Heinlein himself spoke of that when he described the Fosterite religion in *Stranger in a Strange Bed*. So he was familiar with all the tricks and that men were supposed to use to get a lot of partners. Even though, like I said, as best I can tell, he was a happily married man. He just wanted his readers not to grow up to be that or something.
Well, I mean, if he was swinging with his wife, he can't have been entirely happy with her. I don't know. I guess I don't
care. I don't know if he was actually swinging or if he was just going to places. I don't not know the details and don't care to know.
Fair enough.
But what he was preaching, was grotesquely unromantic.
Yeah,
and it's always done in terms of this kind of avuncular. Your bachelor uncle is kind of telling you as a kid, you know, slapping his hand on your shoulder and saying, "Let me tell you how the real world works, kid." And he's going to give you some pragmatic advice because pragmatism was really big among these people. He's not trying to sound idealistic, and he's just trying to sound realistic and to make sure that people can get along and have a good time and so on and so forth. And it's all bunk. It's all lies, okay?
Humans...
There's a guy I know who learned how to treat women from A Princess of Mars. John Carter of Virginia is his hero, and he was always polite to women, and he always was protective of them, and he would have killed four guardsmen for, you know, to talk to her. He never had a chance to, just keep in mind, but still... Isn't that a better lesson to teach to the 13-year-olds who have a crush on Yvonne Craig, you know, than this trash? Than saying, yeah, sleep around with women. That I have to mention, in that scene that offended me so much, the three girls are never given names.
They don't need
names. He has intimate coitus. He has intimate relations with those women. He holds them in her arms, whispers sweet nothings in her ears, and they have no personality. They're just empty sex bots to him? That's disgusting.
Of course, but I think you need to keep in mind that our culture today, as far as I can tell, has a platonic ideal regarding sexuality. And as far as I can tell, that platonic ideal of sort of perfect, our culture... the platonic ideal of sex in our culture is masturbating alone in the dark to pornography, I think.
and dying in misery, but
the thing is,
the Playboy guy.
Well, yeah, but think about it. I mean, people go, "Oh, don't be silly," but think about it. Our culture is not actually interested in having sex. It's interested in orgasms, but it's not actually interested in sex at all. I mean,
right.
You take, look at hookup apps and contraception. So you take the sex act, you make it as sterile as possible so there will be no children.
Correct.
And then you want to have it with someone who literally like the character in Glory Road, doesn't know the name of the partner. They're a warm hole for the night. And
correct.
You have completely sterile sex, ideally with someone you will never see again. You will see once, or you'll see once, then never see again and never call. And you will, you don't even need to know their name, really. I mean, you know, we just are not evolved enough to get to the point of not knowing each other's name. And then you go away, like, the other person is just entirely for your enjoyment. They're not. You don't care about them at all. You want absolutely no connection with them at all as a human being. I mean,
let me mention one other thing about A Princess of Mars, because what you're speaking about sounds like a science fiction story to me of what the utopian version of what the utopian version of sex would sound like in a dystopia, right? In 1984, Big Brother was trying to eliminate the orgasm. Whereas in Brave New World, they were trying to addict people to orgasms as much as possible, but all the sex was being conducted by having people grown in bottles, cloned, or, you know, raised by the state. It was Plato's utopian republic, where all the children are raised by the state, and the parents are just bred like horses through eugenics. Now, here's why I think it's a science fiction story. It's a science fiction dystopia that is not a story. It's coming real around us. It's the world we live in now. The Green Martians, according to that most honest of historians, John Carter of Virginia, lay eggs. And they, after the incubation period, they swap the eggs and hand them out, like the Spartans did, to whichever mothers are available. Because they don't need to be nursed, they're not mammals, you know. And so there's no family bonds ever formed. The reason why the Green Martians are so savage and violent is because they own all property in common, which means they never accumulate any property and they never work for anything. And they share all the children in common, which means they never form any family bonds. So they don't care whether they live or die because they have no one to love and no one who loves them. In fact, the one girl who knows her father, Sola, the daughter of Tars Tarkas, the war chief, illegally, against the custom of the Green Martians, found out who her father was. And her father illegally, and against the custom of the Green Martians, loved and knew the woman, his mate, you see. They actually got married secretly. You see, that's what a romantic writes. What an anti-romantic, what a person who's, you know, working for the devil writes, is Heinlein, who says, let's all go live in Playboy Mansion. That will be fun. Well, yes, sure, it'll be fun for a night.
Yeah.
What do you do the next morning? Well, I had a friend in school, not to tell tales out of school, but I had a friend in college who was a skirt chaser, who I admired, because I wanted to be like him. I wanted to be as successful as he was at the prospect of sniffing after women. I'm really happy that I was a flop with chicks. Okay, let's not put on any false modesty. But he also told me about how the women that he seduced, my friend would seduce, would come back the next day and hang around. And I said, well, didn't you want to see them again? And he'd say, no, I didn't even want to see them the rest of the evening. I wanted to shove them out of bed when I was done with them.
Yeah.
I thought, really? No, I didn't punch my friend in the face, but I think I should have done. And so one of them, who was apparently pregnant, or at least thought she was, came by and made a huge fuss, as you might imagine, because she wanted a father for her child, and smashed the things on his deck and wrecked his room, you know. Now, being a flop with chicks, I never had any scenes like that happen to me. But then again, I didn't have 5 or 10 ex-girlfriends either,
yeah.
You see. Nor was my heart ever broken by a woman who spurned me after using me, like, you know. Like a sack of old potatoes. Now, here's the difference. I'm a romantic. I think that infatuation has a purpose in life. It's to lead to love. It's to make you brave enough to propose to the girl. Otherwise, you'd be too cowardly. Okay, let's just be blunt about it, gentlemen. You wouldn't have the guts to do it unless you were deeply infatuated. But infatuation is a spark plug. It's not meant to run the engine. The engine is love, and love is calm and patient and... It happens on the rainy days as well as the sunny days, in sickness and in health, okay? At weal and at woe, richer or poorer, that's what the deal is, okay?
Yes.
And so living with a woman when you're during the days when you're poor and unhealthy and she's got to hold your hand when you're in bed and so on, that's the deal. That's what love is. What love is not is fun at the Playboy Mansion, because what do you do once the woman is 30 or 40, you know? Once the Playboy bunny's looks have fled,
trade her in for a younger mom.
How many children is she going to have? Is she going to be a good mom? If she sleeps around, how loyal is she going to be to you if she takes the vow?
She's not.
Do you see the problem?
No. Oh, yes,
it's,
of course.
It's the problem is with these science fiction writers who tried to convince me as a child, and Heinlein was not the only one. They all were on the side of changing the morals of society because they said, well, the future will be different. The future will all be more free. The future will all be more
fun. And hasn't that worked out well, particularly for women?
I think that the people who wrote dystopias were much closer to the mark than the people who wrote about worldwide orgies and all the liberties we would enjoy.
Well, I mean, what is it they say? Women today are freer than ever and are more miserable than ever.
Yeah, because the freedom to be selfish is not satisfying. We are not, as human beings, we are not designed. Whether you believe in God or not, if either you believe in God or you believe in Darwin, okay? In neither case are you designed or evolved to live for yourself. The selfish gene theory is stupid. Even if you don't believe in God and you believe in Darwin, we are evolved to mate, okay? And using sex for some non-mating purpose is unsatisfying and makes you crazy. I'll point out that of the LGBT community, only the B can actually perform the sex act. Everyone else is masturbating. And the B only does it half the time.
Effectively, okay? Yes.
Yes. So, and no chaste person can be bisexual because you're supposed to have sex once with your wife after you're married and with no other partner. I'm sorry, that's the rules. And those rules are not designed to be mean to you. It's like a guy complaining about his safety belt. I want to drive with no safety belt and on the wrong side of the road because I'll have more freedom that way. Well, yeah, but you're going to get into a car wreck that way too, you moron.
Yeah, well.
Before you take down the retaining wall, let's find out what the wall was put up to stop. Exactly. Thank you very much, Mr. As if I may quote, misquote G.K. Chesterton.
Yes.
Don't tear down a wall until you know what it's there for.
Well, yeah. Well, on that note, so what's the solution? Get married, have a family, be a countercultural rebel.
And also do not patronize science fiction books who tell you that in the future, all your childhood fantasies are going to come true. The future is going to be like the past, except for older. And we're going to be problems, and there'll be poor among you always, and there'll be wars and rumors of war up until the end. So don't go thinking it's either going to be a utopia or a dysutopia. There will be rainy days, and there will be sunny days. And living in the world is like getting into a marriage. You're here for weal or for woe, for richer or for poorer, for better or worse. So if you're going to write fantasies about the future, then think about the way it would really turn out. Think about a realistic future. Be as fanciful as you like. But think about the way the future would really act and try to tell people what the consequences of their action are. Because if science fiction should be about anything, it should be about the consequences of our actions, of what we're doing now, as to how it's going to affect the future.
Mm. Well, thank you for joining me today, John. And if you've enjoyed the show, like, share, and subscribe. And we'll talk to you next time.